I was asked if I would meet with the staff at my house. As I said, the embassy was uninhabitable. They all came over and said basically that they, whenever possible, they wanted out, but they'd had enough. And I said, I understood that. But I had hoped, and was encouraged by each person saying, I'd like to finish this, finish that, before going. So we worked it out very nicely so that people basically opted themselves of when they would go. We immediately, there was a request by the State Department for volunteers to fill in behind. And so we started to receive some volunteers, certainly by March, I guess, probably, certainly on into April. People came out really on TDY. That was the beginning. And so the TDYs were several of the people who had been stationed at the embassy. A couple of them were out of the country when things happened, came back, and felt again that they wanted to help for a period of time. Nobody except two individuals wanted to stay, and that was Mike Matrenko and Victor Tomasek. They opted to stay on. I urged them both to consider very strongly that desire, but they both said yes, they'd like to stay on. They're big boys, that's your choice. But all the rest of us, really by mid-late June, were out, who had been there. There were some in the military, Phil Gass for one, and one or two people in his staff might have stayed longer. Phil stayed on until October. But again, the Defense Department sent in TDY people to help out. So we were operating really from hand to mouth. Few come in for a month and go. It was really later, it was with the expectation in May that Ambassador Cutler would be going out sometime in June, July, that the State Department started to ask for people to go to Tehran on assignment. And so you started to get people come out on a more permanent basis.
As you were leaving?
As I was leaving.
Any agency people back at that stage? Or
not on a permanent basis, no.
Did you do any more work on Iran when you returned to Washington?
I did not. Well, that's not quite true for Henry Prep was exhausted. And after I'd been home for a few days, he'd asked me if I'd very informally sit in my old seat as Director of Iranian Affairs for a couple of weeks while he had got some terribly well-deserved leave. And so I did that. I was basically sitting around and moping around, basically, but keeping the papers running. But I had very little recollection of anything I did that was useful in that period, except meet with DOD people to impress upon them the need to be forthcoming on a minimum shipment of spare parts if that became possible. And I found that I somehow had been misled, that there was I had misunderstood perhaps, that there was sort of this real block at the Pentagon. I found that was not true at all. The general in charge of that program had, I think, $5 million or $10 million ready to ship the next day if the proper financial and other arrangements could be made. So in August, I went on to Davidson College as diplomat in residence, and that was the end of my direct experience.
That's sort of a wrap-up question. I'll ask you to comment on a statement by James Phil. In his recent book, Phil concludes, and I think I'm simplifying his argument a bit, but he concludes in general that U.S. policy was a failure in the sense that the U.S. never really understood Iranian society. And probably it was a failure of policy in the sense that policymakers took it for granted or assumed that the Shah's position was invulnerable. And this assumption led to very serious problems. How would you assess James Phil's general argument that there was a policy failure?
There's certainly elements of accuracy, truth to it. I think what I read Jim's book recently. I forget how much he gets into this, but U.S. policy has been driven from the Fulton, Missouri speech of Churchill, America's great concern about the Soviet Union, and the people who have run our foreign policy have approached the world in a fairly simple geopolitical fashion. I guess if I'm anything, I'm a geopolitician as well. But this larger view, these larger interests with respect to the Soviet Union and China, the overwhelming drive to our policy with respect to Iran. And I think Jim is partly right that because Iran was conceived by our leadership, certainly from the 60s on and to a degree in the 50s, Iran is of such great importance to us. I'll go back to the Truman Doctrine and all the rest of it as a consequence. That we did not pay as much attention as time went on, as we should have, to the fabric of the Iranian society and its internal inconsistencies, if you will. As a result, when the crisis hit us in 1978, we were really not, certainly in the early stages, terribly well informed. Also, as I'd say, is an intellectual failure, we didn't have a conceptual basis for sort of looking at the country. And certainly as Americans, we tend to view revolutions as sort of progressive, leftist, etc. So there was a perception gap, as even then as time went on, of what the revolution was really about. Jim is correct in the sense that very few people had any real understanding of Shia Islam. Almost everybody, a substantial number of us at the embassy, had served many years in Islamic countries, had read a great deal about Islam, but did not have a real grasp of Shia Islam, its history and its traditions. So there's an intellectual failure of all of us and people preceding us involved. I think the key thing that probably Jim is driving at is that we had, by the early 60s, by the early 70s, with the enunciation of the Nixon Doctrine, and in effect, the willing election of the Shah to be the primary agent for the protection of our and Western interests in that area, there's certainly not much of a willingness to go into heavy, even if we had the capability, the hard analysis of what the situation was around. We should have learned something. I think we did learn something from that. We probably haven't learned enough. But there's a total unwillingness because of to even look at the facts until February 14th was probably when people suddenly realized what was going on. Because we put so much of our hopes and our expectations, our policies in the Shah's basket. I've told Iranians since that they never understood how much the Shah ran the relationship contrary to us running it. And there was this total reliance on really one man. And he was a man with whom, was a brilliant man in many ways, a man whose geopolitical views were very similar to ours, to Kissinger's, to Russ. So it was easy. We got a great deal out of that relationship. And here's with Jim. He's right in one sense because the relationship, obviously, we've had 10 bad years. But we also had 20 awfully good years. We had those important intelligence sites and cooperation. The Shah cooperated with us in helping Egypt with all the countries we've gone through, the reasons. So if you want to say that up until 1978, it was a very successful policy, and since 78, obviously, our successes have come home to roost. Had we not helped, and really I say helped in a minor sort of way, overthrow Mossadegh and have the relationship been a more natural one as we have, say, would we have been better off in the 30 some years since? That's a matter of personal judgment. I think the policy was highly successful for a while. That's very successful. So the seeds of the present problems. I don't know what's more valuable. You have to make so many assumptions of what might have occurred had we not intervened in the Mossadegh period, had we not elected the Shah with the willingness to do certain things. It's the kind of speculation I find fairly fruitless. I think one lesson we should learn, however, though, is that reliance on one man, we just saw yesterday our heavy reliance on a great concern over General Zia of Pakistan, his death. A policy becomes terribly fragile and terribly vulnerable, is the word I'm looking for, when that much reliance is put on one individual. And I suppose there may be other lessons to be learned in terms of relying upon a person, particularly if it's authoritarian and dictatorial. As I said to you before, I don't believe really in too much fiddling around in the internal affairs of governments unless it's very either a clear, neat, attainable objective. But the people in this day and age, in most countries, the people are going to tolerate it so long. And so you are going to get your losses at the end for the gains. And maybe that's a very bearable situation. And from a long-term planning by the United States government is 2 years, 4 years, 8 years maximum, and hardly anybody has really looks ahead more than a few months in our government, it's unfortunate. So you play the situation as you receive it when a new administration comes in. And the next administration will obviously have to take geopolitical realities, things will kind of play around with the world as we find it. I think it was a great tragedy that we and the Iranian people suffered from this revolution, to the extent that we played a role in this tragedy, one can only be deeply regretful. I'm not one of the liberal breastfeeders who says it was all our fault. It wasn't. We contributed, but so did thousands and millions of other people contributed to the debacle. Who knows, out of this 10 years of horror, I do look upon it as horror, maybe there will be, in due course, some sort of a synthesis by which the Iranian people will have a more stable and promising future. I'm dubious of that happy result, but I can hope so because I dearly enjoyed my association with that country and with its people, and I only wish them the very best in the next century, in the next decade, and in the next century. If I had any more insight, I would certainly pass it on, but I really don't. I think the administration, in its handling of Marcos, in its handling of Papadoc, Duvalier, probably either consciously or unconsciously, some conclusions, some lessons. If so, that's good. But I do despair at times that we are people who are very slow to learn lessons from past experience. By the way, I have enjoyed very much chatting with you.
Thanks very much for your time, Mr. Nelson.